We're on Ezra chapter 5 right now in this particular hour. Now, we saw in Ezra chapter 4 that the work was stalled. And the work was stalled by enemies, by opposition. We understand that, well, it's been put like this, and it's kind of a nice little phrase, that whenever the work of God is revived, the second party to be revived is the devil. And there's opposition that comes up. Whenever God's doing something, it's very rare that it goes unopposed by the enemy of our soul and his allies for very long. However, in the big picture, even though we were kind of deflated by this panorama of opposition that came against the work in Jerusalem described to us in Ezra chapter 4, we have the benefit of knowing the end of the story. Look, does this temple get built or not? Yes. So we take comfort. We read this with different eyes than those who would just wonder, did this temple ever get built? I don't know. Maybe it stopped right here. Maybe the Samaritans and the trouble that they stirred up and the lying letter that they wrote, maybe it sunk the whole work and it never happened. But you and I, we know this temple got built. Now, by the way, we can take in advance a little bit of the same comfort because we know how the big story in the history of humanity ends. I mean, we know that Jesus wins. We know that he reigns. We know that all things are brought before the judgment of God. We know that the Lord omnipotent reigns and he will reign forever and ever. We have utter complete confidence in that. So in the same way that we see this opposition in chapter 4, but it really didn't get us that down. We're kind of like, oh, okay, yeah, this always happens. What can we learn from it? But yet we were confident in the fact that God would win his victory because we know it worked out that way. We can have a little bit of that same confidence in advance in the great big picture of what God is doing. Now, let's begin here at verses 1 and 2 of Ezra chapter 5, and we'll see how the construction is resumed. Verse 1. Then the prophet Haggai and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, prophets, prophesied to the Jews who were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel, who was over them. So Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, rose up and began to build the house of God, which is in Jerusalem, and the prophets of God were with them, helping them. Now notice, we have two prophets coming forth here, Haggai and Zechariah. The words of the prophet Haggai to this community of the returned exiled is in the Old Testament book that bears his name. The heart of this prophecy is something that we saw back in Haggai chapter 1, verses 2 through 10. They proclaim this message. And in Haggai chapter 1, verses 2 through 10, we see that the prophet rebuked the people for their attitude towards the building of the temple. This was their attitude, and I'm quoting now from Haggai chapter 1. They said, "The time has not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built." In saying this, the people made their excuse sound spiritual. They couldn't speak against the idea of building the temple, so they spoke against its timing. It isn't God's timing to rebuild the temple, is essentially what they said. Now, how this kind of worked out, and I'm going to do a little hypothetical here because this is one of those situations that we kind of wish the scriptures told us a little more than it did, but I think what I'm going to describe to you is reasonable to think that this is how it happened. They come back from exile. They come to Jerusalem. Are they excited about building the temple? Yes. Did you think that was like a trick question? Are they excited about building the temple? Are they willing to sacrifice and give to the building of the temple? Yes. Were they excited when the foundation of the temple was set? Yes. Were they bummed out when the lying letters came from the Samaritans, the opposition for their adversaries, and the work had to cease? Yes, they were bummed out by all that. Okay, all of that, answers of yes. But what happens in the course of time? Well, we saw that this work went on hold, and I'm speaking off the top of my head here. I may be wrong in this exact number, so if I'm wrong in this, give me a little bit of grace. We said that the work stopped for about 15 years. Well, I can imagine that it went like this. They're all excited. The work is stopped. And then as time goes on, the work could have been started again. But what happened? They got distracted. And if you look at Haggai, it looks like what they got distracted by was the building of their own homes, the advancing of their own business. So there came a time, I don't know how far it was. Maybe it was 5 years into this. Maybe it was 10 years into this. Maybe it was 12 years into this. But there came a time where they could have started the work again, but now their problem wasn't opposition from the outside. Now their problem was distraction in their own lives. And they made it with spiritual spending. You know, we can sound pretty spiritual over the things we want to make excuses for, can't we? I'm pretty good at that. I don't know if you are. They were pretty good about it in Haggai's day too. Where they say, oh, it's not the Lord's timing. We're really, they should be concerned and busy about doing the work of God and building the temple, that fire that they once had at one time. But instead they found it very, oh, it's not the Lord's timing. It's not time for us to do this. Therefore, the prophet Haggai rebuked them with pointed words. This is what Haggai says in verse 1. Is it time for yourselves to dwell in your paneled houses and this temple to lie in ruins? Now look, originally the work was stopped because of outside opposition. Was there much they could do about that? No. But somewhere along the line they could have started the work again, and they didn't. The problem then was simply wrongly ordered priorities. They were content to let the cause of God suffer at the expense of their own comfort. You know what? I know the temple of God lies in ruins, but you should look at that new paneling in my pool table room. That's the kind of thing they would be saying. They should have felt no rest until the work of God was as prosperous as their personal lives. And they should have been as willing to sacrifice for the work of God as they were willing to sacrifice for their personal comfort and luxury. Now, isn't this so true according to human nature? Isn't it so true that sometimes a work gets stopped or stalled out of circumstances that we have nothing to do with, but then later on it just kind of morphs into something that we could start it up again, but now we're not willing. So what did God say to them? God spoke to the people through the prophet. Again, I'm quoting from Haggai chapter 1. Consider your ways. Go up to the mountains and bring wood and build the temple that I may take pleasure of it in it and be glorified. Somewhere along the line in that 15 years, God had to give them a swift kick in the behind and say, get busy. Get working on this. And he sent his prophet Haggai to do it. Sometimes God's cause needs work. Yes, the work is supported by prayer, but this was a work that had to go beyond prayer. Don't just pray. Go up to the mountains and get some wood and bring it down and start building the temple. Don't just pray, but get busy with the work that you're praying to happen. The people had allowed a delay beyond their control to become a delay of their own choosing. Okay, that was what Haggai the prophet addressed, mentioned there in verse 1. Now, verse 1 also mentions Zechariah, the son of Iddo. Some of Zechariah's prophecy is also recorded for us in the book of Zechariah. Now, Haggai's prophecy was a more direct encouragement to get busy on the work of building the temple. Zechariah's prophecy was more directed to the spiritual condition of the returning exiles. The name Zechariah means the Lord remembers, and it's a fitting name for a prophet who spoke to this time of restoration. He was called to encourage and mobilize God's people for a task that they had started, had stalled, and now they needed momentum to continue it and to complete it. He worked with these others. He worked with Haggai. He worked with Zerubbabel. He worked with Ezra. He warned them of the consequences of neglecting God's work. And what Zechariah especially emphasized was the idea that God wants to do a work all through his people. Now, what's interesting is, if we only had Haggai's prophecy from this period, we would think that all God was interested in was the building of the temple, because that's Haggai's emphasis. But Zechariah shows us that God was not only concerned about the material construction of the temple, though he was concerned about that, in an even greater way, he was concerned about the spiritual condition and state of the people. In any regard, verse 2 says, we're back here to Ezra chapter 5, verse 2, and the prophets of God were with them, helping them. The work of these prophets was effective, and it helped the people properly reorder their priorities to resume the building work on the temple. Verse 2 says that they rose up and began to build the house of God. Now, this verse indicates that the work of Haggai and Zechariah went beyond the directly prophetic. Did you catch that sense in verse 2? The sense in verse 2 is that Haggai and Zechariah helped in the actual work. They picked up a hammer and did what they could to help along the way, which I'm sure was a special encouragement. Sometimes it's discouraging if you have a prophet like Haggai sitting on a beach chair with an iced tea in his hand, prophesying to everybody what they should do. When the prophet prophesies what they should do, but then gets up and actually helps in the work, how much greater of an encouragement is that? Well, verse 3, we see the work continuing. We read there, at the same time, Tattenai, the governor of the region beyond the river, and Shethar Boznai and their companions came to them and spoke thus to them. Who has commanded you to build this temple and finish this wall? Then accordingly, we told them the names of the men who were constructing this building. But the eye of their God was upon the elders of the Jews, so that they could not make them cease till a report could go to Darius. Then a written answer was returned concerning this matter. Now, this man, Tattenai, the governor of the region beyond the river, this was the man appointed by the king of Persia to govern the province that included Judea. He and his companions wanted to know, hey, the last we heard, like 15 years ago, you guys shouldn't be working on this. Why has this work resumed? Well, again, the opposition comes, but what did they do? They didn't put down their hammers, so to speak. Verse 4 says, accordingly, we told them the names of the men. Listen, there's no hint of rebellion here. These guys aren't doing the work behind masks. You know, this isn't some weird demonstration where everybody hides their face. You want to know who the guys are doing the work? We'll give you the list. We've got nothing to hide here. But notice, when they did the work in boldness, in spiritual initiative, knowing that they had nothing to hide, look at the blessing of God upon it in verse 5. But the eye of their God was upon the elders of the Jews, so that they could not make them cease. God's blessing was upon them, so that the work resumed under a response to the prophets of God and did not have to stop almost as soon as it started. The work was continuing, and this was a confirmation of God's hand of blessing upon it. Now again, don't think that God just started looking at them, but this means that his eye was upon them in verse 5 in a special way, and they did it, notice here, till a report could go to Darius. And that was good. That was good that a report was going to go to Darius about this. Why was it good? Well, the first reason it was good was because in those days, getting a letter from one place to another would take weeks and weeks and weeks. They could get a lot of construction done. While the letter went to Darius, he figured out what to do with it, and the answer came back. The second reason it was good was because they had nothing to hide. The truth was on their side, and they weren't sorry that anybody knew it. So they could go on. They were happy about that. So this is the letter to King Darius, starting in verse 6. Ready for this? We read, this is a copy of the letter that Tattenai sent, the governor of the region beyond the river, and Shethar Boznai and his companions, the Persians who were in the region beyond the river, to Darius the king. I like this. This is a copy of the letter. Tattenai was a good administrator. He sent a letter and he made a copy. He put the copy in his files. I mean, this guy was a good administrator. He knew what he was doing. Verse 7. Do you guys know that? I mean, there was actually a time where people would write letters and like make copies of things and file copies. Do you guys do you have any knowledge of what a carbon copy is? You guys ever seen carbon paper in your life? Raise your hand if you know what carbon paper is. Carbon paper was awesome. Carbon paper was like this black, filmy stuff that you would put behind a letter, and when you typed on the carbon paper, or I suppose you could write, it was pressure that did it. The black, filmy stuff made an impression on the piece of paper behind it. So with carbon paper, you could type two letters at once. At once. This amazing technology, all given to us by the modern age. Listen, when it comes to technology, I am so happy that I was born when I was. Because in a lot of ways, I feel like I get the best of all the old school stuff. I mean, when I first started going to libraries, you use the card catalog. Some of you guys don't even know what a card catalog is, and I don't mean that critically. You just don't. There's no need for them anymore. Card catalogs are completely obsolete. But you used to find a book by looking in these little drawers that had little cards representing. I mean, stuff like that was awesome in the day. So I had the advantage of all that, but I get the advantage of all this today as well, which I think is fantastic. So, yeah, I think you guys would have liked to see all that old school stuff in your day. Verse 7. We all got that just from a copy of the letter right there. Verse 7. They sent a letter to him in which was written thus, to Darius the king, all peace. Let it be known to the king that we went into the province of Judea to the temple of the great God, which is being built with heavy stones, and timber is being laid in the walls. And this work goes on diligently and prospers in their hands. Then we asked those elders and spoke thus to them, who commanded you to build this temple and finish these walls? We also asked them their names to inform you that we might write the names of the men who were chief among them. And thus they returned us an answer saying, we are the servants of the God of heaven and earth, and we are rebuilding the temple that was built many years ago, which a great king of Israel built and completed. But because our fathers provoked the God of heaven to wrath, he gave them into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, the Chaldean, who destroyed this temple and carried the people away to Babylon. However, in the first year of King Cyrus, king of Babylon, King Cyrus issued a decree to build this house of God. Also, the gold and silver articles of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple that was in Jerusalem and carried into the temple of Babylon, those King Cyrus took from the temple of Babylon, and they were given to one named Sheshbazzar, whom he made governor. And he said to him, take these articles, go, carry them to the temple site that is in Jerusalem, and let the house of God be rebuilt on its former site. Then the same Sheshbazzar came and laid the foundation of the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. But from that time even until now, it has been under construction, and it is not finished. Now therefore, if it seems good to the king, let a search be made in the king's treasure house, which is there in Babylon, whether it is so that a decree was issued by King Cyrus to build this house of God at Jerusalem, and let the king send us his pleasure concerning the matter. Okay, who wrote this letter? Did Ezra write this letter? No. Did Zerubbabel write this letter? No. Tattenai, the Persian governor of the province, wrote this letter. But what's amazing about it is he seems to have his facts pretty good, doesn't he? He seems to have a good knowledge of what actually happened. So we're happy in verse 8 when he says, let it be known to the king. Tattenai seems to fairly recount the situation, at least from his perspective. Without prejudice or malice, he explains the matter to King Darius. We want to stand up and applaud. Tattenai, you've done a good job explaining the situation. So he says, the temple's being rebuilt. And by the way, we notice that he said that they were making great progress as they built it. We kind of go, yeah, that's nice to hear. Verse 8, it says that it was being built with heavy stones. Now, I wonder if Tattenai didn't mention the heavy stones out of a little sense of suspicion. Because maybe he thought the heavy stones could be used as a fortification, as a fort, as something like what we would call a castle, you know, to be a place to defend against or defend a rebellion against the king. And then they talk about timber being laid in the walls. He talked about Sheshbazzar came and laid the foundation. That's in verse 16. Now, verse 16, where it says Sheshbazzar came and laid the foundation, This leads many to believe that Sheshbazzar is actually another name for Zerubbabel. I don't think that it's necessarily that they had to be the same people. They could have just been close associates who worked on the work together, but it's not unreasonable to suppose that Sheshbazzar and Zerubbabel are two names for the same man. Nevertheless, in verse 17, Tattenai the governor does a good thing. He says, hey, let a search be made, whether it is so that a decree was issued by King Cyrus to build this house of God at Jerusalem. Respectfully, Tattenai asked King Darius to research the matter to determine if the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem was actually royally sanctioned or not. Okay, that was the whole issue at hand. So they're going to do an investigation. The letter goes back. Shall we just continue on now to chapter 6? I think we're ready for it. Are we ready for chapter 6? Verse 1. Then King Darius issued a decree, and a search was made in the archives where the treasures were stored in Babylon, and at Achmetha, in the palace that is in the province of Medina, a scroll was found, and in it a record was written thus, dot, 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 little suspense there. Let's go back and take a look at verses 1 and 2. The letter goes back to Darius. Darius does his research. Of course, King Darius didn't personally do it. He's a king. He has people that do this kind of work for him. They make a search of the royal records. They do. They get the thing. They found at Achmetha, a scroll was found there. Now, what's interesting, they didn't find the scroll at Babylon. They found it at Achmetha. And maybe if I was more prepared, I could tell you where Achmetha was. All my research tells me right in front of me is that it was a remote city. And the idea here is that they had to make a diligent search to find it. I got to say, this was God. This was God at work, wasn't it? I mean, why should pagan, secular administrators work so hard to find an answer that's going to resolve something possibly in favor of the people of God and the work of rebuilding the temple? Do you know how easy it is for a bureaucrat to just kind of say, whoops, can't find the letter. I guess we don't need to do that. Let's go home early for the day. But they didn't do that. They diligently searched, even going to the remote city of Achmetha, and there they found the scroll. So, in verse 3, here's the actual text of the record that they found, the decree of Cyrus. Ready? In the first year of King Cyrus issued a decree concerning the house of God at Jerusalem. Let the house be rebuilt, and the place where they offered sacrifices, and let the foundation of it be firmly laid, its height 60 cubits and its width 60 cubits, with three rows of heavy stones and one row of new timber. Let the expenses be paid from the king's treasury. Also let the gold and silver articles of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar took from the temple, which is in Jerusalem, and brought to Babylon, be restored and taken back to the temple, which is in Jerusalem, each to its place, and deposit them in the house of God. So this is the decree originally recorded in Ezra chapter 1, the one that gave the Jewish people the right to return to Jerusalem and even gave them support to do the work. That's why it says in verse 3, let the house be rebuilt. And there in verse 4, let the expenses be paid for the king's treasury. This just keeps better and better. They started the rebuilding work. No, let's go back. They started the rebuilding work and they were very excited. Then opposition made them cease. Then it just stopped for a while, and the delay from attack slowly turned into a delay of distraction. And they could have resumed the work, but they didn't. Haggai and Zechariah, the prophets of God, bring the word of God to the people and say, get busy and get rebuilding the temple. They start on the work again with great fervor. And what happens? The governor comes and says, whoa, stop this. We got to look into the work. Actually, he didn't say stop it, continue it. I'm going to look into this. They go back to Persia. They go back to Babylon. They do a search commanded by King Darius. And when they find the records, not only does it say that they should continue the work and rebuild the temple, but it says that the king should pay for it. How awesome is that? I mean, it's just like better and better. Thank you, Lord. Now, this, bless you, this would never have been triggered unless they listened to the word of the prophets and started rebuilding the work. I don't know what they were waiting for. Were they really waiting for the Persian king and the Persian governor to tell them to rebuild the temple? No. They shouldn't have been waiting for that. But when they finally listened to the prophet of God and started doing what God wanted them to do, God opened up doors beyond their expectation. Verse 5, let the gold and silver and articles of the house of God be restored and taken back to the temple, which is in Jerusalem. Yeah, take all that stuff, get it there as just as it was before. Now, we know that many of these things were already transported, but maybe there were a few lying behind that they took as well. I also find it interesting that in verse 4, they specifically mention that it should be rebuilt with three rows of heavy stones. Hey, Tatenai, the governor there of the province, you're worried about those heavy stones? Don't worry about it. The king expressly said we should build this with heavy stones. Don't worry about it. We're just following the king's orders. This was a remarkable example of God's providence. So what a beautiful thing. So now, here's the reply of Darius to Tatenai. Okay, we have Tatenai's letter to Darius. We have the document they found in the archives. And now here's Darius's reply to Tatenai. Ready for this? Has everybody got this ordered in their head correctly? Here we go. Now, starting at verse 6. Now, therefore, Tatenai, governor of the region beyond the river, and Shethar-Boznai, and your companions, the Persians, who are beyond the river, keep yourselves far from there. Let the work of this house of God alone. Let the governor of the Jews and the elders of the Jews build this house of God on its site. Moreover, I issue a decree as to what you should do for the elders of these Jews for the building of this house of God. Let the cost be paid at the king's expense from taxes on the region beyond the river. And this is to be given immediately to these men, so they're not to be hindered. And whatever they need, young bulls, rams, and lambs for the burnt offerings of the God of heaven, wheat, salt, wine, and oil, according to the request of the priests who are in Jerusalem, let it be given to them day by day without fail, that they may offer sacrifices of sweet aroma to the God of heaven and pray for the life of the king and his sons. Also, I issue a decree that whoever alters this edict, let a timber be pulled from his house and erected, and let him be hanged on it. And let his house be made a refuse heap because of this. And may the God who causes his name to dwell there destroy any king or people who put their hand to alter it or destroy this house of God which is in Jerusalem. I, Darius, issue a decree. Let it be done diligently. Right, now, that's pretty amazing, don't you think? Isn't this a miracle of God working through a pagan king? Remember what it says in Proverbs, that the heart of the king is in the hand of God, and he guides it wherever he pleases. That's exactly what he's doing here with Darius and the work that goes back to Jerusalem. So the first thing he says in verse 7, let the work of the house of God alone. By the way, it's wonderful if the government just leaves us alone to do our work. That's great. But then he says to Tatenai, the governor of the region beyond the river, I just don't want you to leave it alone. I want you to fund it. Yes, as verse 7 says, let them build the house of God on its site. But, verse 8, let the cost be paid at the king's expense. I can only imagine that Zerubbabel and the other Jewish leaders, when they saw this, they could hardly believe their eyes. We've been struggling along, making good progress, doing the best we can, but we've got limited resources. We're doing the very best we can with our limited resources, but the work is difficult. Now they had what must have seemed to them to be unlimited resources at their disposal. The work was going to be funded, verse 8 says, by taxes on the region beyond the river, the local taxes. By the way, Darius did what is common for politicians to do. He put the burden of raising revenue for this on the province itself, not on the national government. That's where the taxes were to come from. And it was funded in a very impressive manner. Verse 9 says, whatever they need. And then later in verse 9, let it be given to them day by day without fail. This was a very substantial grant that was given to them. So you see this, the objections by Tatenai and Shethar Bozenai earlier in Ezra chapter 5, those objections ended up furthering the work of God. Brothers and sisters, if we are confident in the calling and the work of God, we don't need to fear opposition. Because even if opposition should, for a period of time, delay the work of God, it will never ruin it. What I find fascinating about this equation is, think about it in terms of this. Now, let's just throw out a figure here. Let's just say that for 8 years, they were delayed by the government in doing this. And let's just say for 7 years, they could have resumed the work, but they were just too distracted to do it. What I want you to understand by this is that this 8-year delay, now I would say God did not ordain the 7-year delay. That was due to the carnality of his people. But the 8-year delay, yes, God allowed an 8-year delay, but he allowed it so that the work would go on better and with less opposition than ever. God's plan was sure and secure for the people. Now, there's also interesting here, points to notice in this text here. Look at verse 10, where it says, and pray for the life of the king and his sons. This explains part of the motivation of King Darius. Not only did he base his decision on the precedent of King Cyrus, he wanted the Jewish people to pray for himself and his sons. So much so that in verse 11, he says that if anyone was to oppose the work, what should be done to them? Well, they should take a timber from their house and let him be hanged on it. Okay, now who are we talking about? We're talking about the Persians. You and I, we associate crucifixion with the Romans. The Romans did not invent crucifixion. The Persians invented crucifixion. This may have been an early form of persecution. He may have been saying, go to the biggest pillar, the biggest board, the biggest piece of wood in the guy's house, rip it out from the house, pound it in the ground, and nail the figure upon it. This may very well have been an early form of crucifixion, I should say, that was invented by the Persians. The Romans adopted the process of crucifixion from the Persians. What we like at the end of this in verse 12 is where it says, let it be done diligently. Get it done. At the end of it all, the king of the mightiest empire on earth at that time commanded that the temple be finished by the returned exiles and funded by the king himself. That's a pretty sweet arrangement. Now, there are historical records of Persian monarchs doing similar things for other nations that they conquered. So this is a wonderful blessing of God, but it is not completely unprecedented for the Persian monarchs to do this. And imagine how surprised Tatenai, the governor, was when he finally received this letter. He must have blinked 2 or 3 times and said, okay, not only are we supposed to allow this, but we're supposed to help it along and fund it completely. What a powerful illustration of the proverb that I just read to you before. Proverbs 21:1, the king's heart is in the hand of the Lord like the rivers of water. He turns it wherever he wishes. All right, so should we look now to the finishing of the temple? Verse 13, then Tatenai, governor of the region beyond the river, Shethar Bozenai, and their companions diligently did according to what King Darius had sent. So the elders of the Jews built, and they prospered through the prophesying of Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo. And they built and finished it according to the commandment of the God of Israel and according to the commandment of Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes, king of Persia. Now, The temple was finished on the third day of the month of Adar, which is in the sixth year of the reign of King Darius. Well, they were commanded to do it diligently in verse 12, and they did it diligently as recorded in verse 13. So much so that it says they prospered through the prophesying of Haggai the prophet and of Zechariah. The words and the personal ministry of these prophets was instrumental in seeing the work done that God wanted to do. They were genuinely strengthened by the word of God through these prophets. So they did it. They had to encourage them to press through to the end, and it was finished. Look at verse 15. The temple was finished on the third day of the month of Adar, which was in the sixth year. This means that it took 4 years from the resumption of construction. This was a big job. Everybody was working diligently, but it still took 4 years from the resumption of the destruction to do it, or the resumption of the delay to do it. So this means it was a big job to rebuild this temple and to build it properly. Now, verse 16, the dedication ceremony of the second temple, we read. Then the children of Israel, the priests and the Levites and the rest of the descendants of the captivity celebrated the dedication of this house of God with joy. And they offered sacrifices at the dedication of this house of God, 100 bulls, 200 rams, 400 lambs, and as a sin offering for all Israel, 12 male goats, according to the number of the tribes of Israel. They assigned the priests to their divisions and the Levites to their divisions over the service of God in Jerusalem, as it is written in the book of Moses. Well, you better believe it. If there was joy at the dedication of the foundation laying ceremony some 20 years before this, you can imagine how much joy there was now that the work was completed. So this was a celebration for the finishing of a functioning temple. And it says there in verse 17, look at verse 17 closely, it says that they offered sacrifice. Now, how many animals did they offer? Well, it says right there in verse 17, let me look at it here. It says they offered 100 bulls, 200 rams, 400 lambs, and as a sin offering for all Israel, 12 male goats. So how many is that total, you math majors? 712. I knew that, but just because it was in my notes. 712 animals. You go, can you imagine on that day, the dedication ceremony, slaughtering and sacrificing 712 animals? And 100 of them were bulls, big animals. I think many times we misunderstand what the sacrificial system was all about in the Old Testament. Now, I don't know what your conception of a priest is. Maybe you think of a guy in a black shirt and a white collar, you know, kind of a dainty guy who doesn't get his hands too messy. Let me tell you, in the Old Testament, a priest was much more like a guy who worked in a butcher shop than it was what you think of as a priest today. Sacrificing animals was hard, sweaty, bloody work. Blood all over the place. And can you imagine the coordination, the difficulty, the hard work that would go into sacrificing 712 animals on one day? I mean, if they did it in an 8-hour day, you're talking about what? 80, 90 animals an hour. That's a lot of animals to be offering and sacrificing on the altar. Okay, you have that in your mind? Now let me really blow your mind. At the dedication of Solomon's temple, they dedicated 142,000 animals at the dedication of Solomon. It may have been over a series of days, but still 142,000, something like 20 times the number of sacrifices. Whether you're sacrificing 712 animals on one day or 142,000 animals over a few days, that's a lot of animals, isn't it? Now, we learned before that when they first built the altar, because the altar was established first, was it not? That they established the custom of the morning offering and the evening offering once again as commanded in the law of Moses, right? Now, think about this. After one day when you offer 712 animals, or a few days when you offer 142,000, don't you think you should be able to take a few days off? It doesn't work that way. The next morning, when the sun comes up, you better have the morning offering out there. When the sun goes down, you better have the evening offering. Do you know why? It's a very important principle. Because it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. A sacrifice that can never fully cleanse must be repeated over and over again. If you're never completely cleansed, then you have to be cleansed again and again and again. If a debt is never fully paid, some of you know this with your credit cards. If your debt is never fully paid, you're going to keep paying it forever, forever. And some of you are feeling that right now. Okay, so here's the principle. This is all in contrast to the once-for-all sacrifice made by the Son of God, perfectly at the cross. We are in awe of the sacrifice of Jesus, because what he did was of a completely different order and class of all those animal sacrifices, which could never solve the problem of sin, but the perfect sacrifice of the perfect Son of God could. And after that point, there's never a need for another sacrifice of an animal for atonement's sake ever, ever again. Jesus satisfied it perfectly. That's an awesome thing. Yes, indeed. All right. Now, at the end of that, verse 18, they assigned to the priests and to their divisions, as it is written in the book of Moses, they took care to resume the proper priestly service as commanded by the book of Moses and the previous pattern of David. It was a great, great scene. All right, let's hit it now. Verse 19. And the descendants of the captivity kept the Passover on the 14th day of the first month. For the priests and the Levites had purified themselves. All of them were ritually clean. And they slaughtered the Passover lambs for all the descendants of the captivity, for the brethren, the priests, and for themselves. Then the children of Israel who had returned from the captivity ate together with all who had separated themselves from the filth of the nations of the land in order to seek the Lord God of Israel. And they kept the feast of unleavened bread 7 days with joy, for the Lord made them joyful and turned the heart of the king of Assyria toward them to strengthen their hands in the work of the house of God, the God of Israel. Well, isn't that beautiful? Not long after the dedication of the temple, they celebrated the Passover on the 14th day of the first month. They were careful to keep the Passover according to the commands of Moses on its proper day. One of the reasons this is put in here for us in verse 19 was to tell you Israel's getting their act together. I mean, it really wasn't all that complicated. They were supposed to read what the law of Moses said and do it. When it said, celebrate Passover on the 14th day of the first month, they were supposed to do it. But some now 70 years before, because we're 20 years into it, 50 years of the temple destroyed, 70 years before, in the last season, before the final conquest of Jerusalem, they weren't doing things like that. Now they were different. And they slaughtered the Passover lambs, verse 20 says, for all the descendants of the captivity. They did not themselves sacrifice the Passover lambs. The priests did it for them. Now, what's interesting is it seems as if there was no absolute custom for this. There's some places in the Old Testament where it seems that each individual leader of a household would kill the Passover lamb for themselves. In other places, it seems like priests did it. It just seems that this might differ from age to age in Israel's history. But they did it all, verse 21, with those who had separated themselves from the filth of the nations of the land. Connected with the remembrance of the deliverance of Passover was also the Feast of Unleavened Bread. That marked the purity of God's delivered people. And so they did it so that they would remain a pure people before the Lord. Verse 22 now, it says that the Lord made them joyful. They responded to God with obedience and purity, and God did not allow them to use their joy. I tell you, isn't it funny how we are so often tempted to think this is just part of the madness of fallen humanity? It's as if we want to put obedience on that end. What other word would I choose? Perhaps purity. These are the things that are recognized by their observance of Passover. We want to do that, and over across from that, we want to put joy. In other words, if you really want to be happy and joyful and excited in light, don't worry about obedience and purity. Isn't it funny how so much of Satan's temptation, or maybe I should just say the temptation that comes to us from the world, the flesh, and the devil, is to convince us that these two are in completely different spheres. But it's not true. I mean, this is what the madness of our fallen nature tells us. But we know that in God, obedience and purity really lead to true joy. You want to be happy? You want to be pleased and just happy in life? The pathway to that is through obedience and joy. And so this is it. They were able to, as well, verse 22, to strengthen their hands in the work of the house of God. And so ends this first stage of the book of Ezra. Now there's a gap of 60 years between chapters 6 and 7.